This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Katie Ann McDonald is producing. And we start with one of our favorite guests. We visit with him, if things go according to plan, at least once a year, Chuck Collins, author, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, and co-founder of Wealth for Common Good. And his latest work is The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. Good morning, Chuck.
Having me.
Nice to talk with Chuck Collins, as always. And for those who have been acquainted with previous iterations of discussions with Chuck, he, as a young man, was an heir to the Oscar Mayer fortune, and he gave away his inheritance. And he, of course, did something that few Americans would do. And he has always questioned the ethics of inherited wealth. And that, of course, has influenced his work since. And it, I would think, has something to do with the wealth hoarders, Chuck.
Yeah, and it, my own experience gave me an insight into the role of wealth advisors in sort of encouraging people to build inherited wealth dynasties. So, yeah, that's the book is really about this growing industry of wealth defense industry professionals who make millions hiding trillions, as I say.
Well, it's certainly a catchy phrase, but you say it's more than a phrase. It's the real deal. Are billionaires paying millions to hide trillions?
Absolutely. I mean, I think at the global level, we estimate that, somewhere between $25 and $35 trillion is hidden in offshore tax havens, in trusts, in shell companies, and that that money is not just avoiding taxes, it's avoiding responsibility. Sometimes those are, you know, illegally plundered funds or, you know, ripped off from customers and consumers in this country, and that money then goes into these anonymous accounts. So and it's not really just a sideshow anymore, Jim. It's become very central to kind of the economic system, unfortunately.
Well, it's a situation in which America has a $28 trillion debt. Now, you're saying that almost that much money has been shoved away from public view and without taxation. If we were to tax people properly, and we're talking about, for the most part, the very rich, would we have a balanced budget?
Well, that was a global number, but I think, you know, we can probably safely say $6 to $8 trillion is probably U.S. wealth. And yeah, I think between cracking down on some of the games, you know, that the wealth defense industry plays with money, the shell games to avoid taxes, better enforcing the existing tax rules, and closing down certain kinds of trusts and ways in which the super wealthy hide their money, that could be a tremendous source of revenue. For it may not balance our budget, but it would certainly fill in quite a bit of the hole.
877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number, and talk@talklouisiana.org is our email. For Chuck Collins, his book, The Wealth Hoarders, and he has stated that we have a legal obligation, which I'm sure most of us are aware of, but also a moral one to pay taxes. But we've been subjected over the course of our lives to messages like only morons pay the estate tax. This anti-tax mantra, has it taken hold to the point where people think that paying taxes is a bad thing rather than a good one?
Yeah, I mean, it's been part of the strategy to demonize taxes. And frankly, most people, low and middle income people, I think, are paying too much federal taxes. Partly what's happened is the wealthy have their share keeps going down and they're shifting the bills onto the rest of us. So it is a understandable that people feel burdened. And then right now, the IRS is more likely to audit somebody who gets the earned income credit, you know, a tax credit for low and middle income households, than they are to audit a multi-billionaire who's using one of these trusts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the president has called on Congress to invest more in enforcing the tax rules on the wealthy, and I think that's a really good start, and it would raise substantial revenue from the people most able to pay.
You mentioned some names in The Wealth Hoarders. The name Robert Osterlund, or Oysterlund, you mentioned that he and his wife are multimillionaires and show very little as far as paying taxes. Why did you focus upon him?
Well, there was a really good expose about the Osterlunds, who have roughly $400 million, almost none of it in their own name. And it really came to light when they got divorced. And, you know, one spouse was trying to recover her share. But it's a great case study of they went to the lawyers, they went to the wealth defense industry tax accountants, and basically they moved all these assets that they owned out of what appeared to be their own ownership. And that's what the wealth defense industry does. They take the richest people in the world and make it look on paper like they don't have much. And that's part of the game that they're playing.
A listener notes that in 2016, when President Trump was debating Hillary Clinton, that when he was chided by her for paying little or no taxes, despite saying that he had $10 billion, he said, "That's smart." He's not alone in that point of view, is he?
No. I mean, although what made him smart was that he hired, you know, these tax planners and tax accountants and people to basically hide his money. That's, you know, and that's, it's not smart. It's having access to the resources to do that. I mean, when I say wealthy, in this case, I'm talking about people with $30 million or more, all the way up to the billionaires. And those are the folks who can afford to hire people who create these brain-numbing, very complicated trusts and transactions. I mean, Jim, if you and I started to talk about them, people would, their heads would hurt, you know, changing the dial, because it's so boring and complicated. And that's intentional. They want this to be, they want people to give up on trying to understand how these games work.
You note in The Wealth Hoarders that about 25% of the wealth defense industry, as you call it, are anti-tax libertarians, and another 25% are deeply troubled about the fact that they're making the world a worse place by avoiding taxation. And that leaves 50% in the middle. How might they be encouraged, Chuck, to swing the way to equality?
Well, I think a lot of people work in that profession are unhappy. You know, they're looking and saying, geez, I'm giving my entire life to help the already rich get richer. And the reason we actually know anything about this wealth defense industry is because of leaks, because people who work for these wealthy folks and realize it's not a good thing have provided information and data and taught me. I wrote this book. I interviewed a bunch of very disgruntled people working in this sector. And some of them are helping draft legislation to close down the loopholes that they help create. So I think, you know, the more people realize, wow, there is other work you can do. You don't have to work for the billionaires to help them hide their money. Find other honorable work, you know, that could make a huge difference. And I think some of those people are jumping track.
You refer to some citizens as patriotic millionaires. What makes a patriotic millionaire, Chuck Collins?
Oh, well, there is a whole group that's called the Patriotic Millionaires, and these are folks who, in this case, aren't, you know, aggressively using every loophole. They believe that they should pay their fair share of taxes, that that's what makes America great. They believe their country is more important than their own private wealth, and they're willing to speak their mind, pay higher taxes. And they are really important because they kind of demystify how the system works. And actually that group has a new book out called Tax the Rich, which is basically making the arguments that they, as patriotic millionaires, should pay higher taxes.
In looking at the National Debt Clock website, the median income in the U.S. now is $35,450 per person. 21 years ago, it was $31,112. So it's only risen 14%. And at the same time, Chuck, the U.S. workforce has fallen from 160 million to 151 million. 9 million Americans working, fewer Americans working today than in 2000, when we had fewer people. And in the U.S., there are 333 million of us who are citizens, and only 125 million pay any taxes. Is there something wrong with what is happening? And based on these numbers, it's apparent that people in the middle are being squeezed. The cost of a new home, the median cost today is $326,000. 2000 is $163,000. It's doubled. The cost of living is going up, but people are not making the money to keep up with it. There is massive frustration, it appears, for good reason, from those in the middle. But are they subject to paying more taxes as well, or are you just looking at those at the very top?
No, I think, as you pointed out, wages have been stagnant for 40 years, and the middle class is overtaxed. And meanwhile, the super rich have seen their taxes go down steadily.
All right, we're going to take a 90-second pause and return for another segment with Chuck Collins. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Chuck Collins is with us, a philanthropic gentleman on the East Coast who gave his fortune that he inherited from Oscar Mayer to good causes, supposedly good causes. And he grew up in Madison, Wisconsin. He is 61 years old and has a lot of gas left in the tank, and he is using his energy to spread the word that we need to at least spread the wealth, that it's congregated too much in this country, and it continues to be consolidated at the very top more so than anywhere else. And we live in a state in Louisiana where still, on the record, there is only one billionaire in the whole state, and that is Gail Benson, who inherited her fortune from her husband, Tom, who owned the New Orleans Saints. She is worth more than $3 billion. His book is The Wealth Hoarders, and it often shows, as Warren Buffett stated, that he pays fewer taxes on a percentage basis than people who work in his office. And is that an overstatement, an exaggeration, or is that fact, Chuck Collins?
No, that is the case because, you know, Warren Buffett's wealth, His income comes from his owning assets, comes from Berkshire Hathaway. So capital gains income from assets is taxed at a much lower rate than income from work. And that's one of the things that's broken in the current tax system. We tax sweat more than we tax, you know, sitting on assets.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. For Chuck Collins in our remaining segment with him. His book is The Wealth Hoarders. David in Lafayette says, if the middle does not like being squeezed, they should vote out the Congress who support the rich folks. And Congress, on the whole, is tilted toward those who brought them to the dance, and often rich people write checks for people running for Congress. Is this a vicious cycle that is part of the problem, Chuck?
It is part of a cycle, unfortunately. As wealth concentrates, as you pointed out, Jim, the more wealth and power get concentrated. And so, you know, the problem is when people have $30 million or more, it's not that we're against people having wealth. It's that that becomes power, the power to lobby, the power to shape the rules. And as a certain small number of families get wealthier and wealthier, and a couple hundred global companies get more and more economic power, they use that power to tip the rules in their favor. And that's so it's true. What to the extent we have any power as voters, we should be saying, hey, look, how about a tax system that's fair, where we don't have a separate set of rules for the richest 0.1%, that they should pay their fair share. And if a politician doesn't support that, then move them on.
Another listener, Tracy at the Capitol, says, how can we frame this without making it a partisan issue, pitting left against right?
Well, you know, I think it isn't a partisan. I think it's not because, you know, at the end of last year, Congress passed and President Trump signed legislation called the Corporate Transparency Act, which is an attempt to get corporations to disclose who their real owners are. And that had Republicans and Democrats. It had law enforcement and people who care about tax fairness all together. So it's not a, it's an issue of how do we stop corruption of the existing tax system, and that is a totally bipartisan issue.
Would it help if some kind of massive reform came from the right rather than the left, based on the perception that those on the left are trying to get in your pocket and those on the right are trying to lower taxes at all costs.
Yeah, no, I think it would be good. I don't see the people on the right stepping up on the whole issue of tax fairness. You know, 2017, the tax cut that the Republicans passed that had no Democratic votes and had all Republican votes was a $2 trillion giveaway, mostly to global corporations who have not done anything to create jobs. And they've weakened the system and weakened enforcement. So, you know, it would be great if conservatives stepped up and said, yeah, we should enforce the tax code on the wealthy. But they're kind of almost chronically anti-tax. So it would be great to find allies if there are people out there listening who feel like millionaires and billionaires should pay their fair share of taxes. Let's get all together.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Louisiana, very few people would be affected by the president's tax plan to raise taxes on only those earning over $400,000 a year. But yet it's states like Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama, the Deep South, where they have fewer people who have the kind of vast wealth that you're talking about. They're against the Biden plan. And then you have a state like California, which has more billionaires than any other state by far. And for the most part, the state of California is on board. How do you explain that?
You know, it's one of the great mysteries in American politics. You know, the states that get the most from federal government tax benefit, you know, are the ones who vote against having a fair tax system. I think it's time. You know, one good news is I think most people understand the wealthy have not been paying their fair share over the decades. So even among, you know, 70-80% of the population supports a wealth tax on people with $1 billion or over 50 million. So there's more and more, there's more people who are saying, you know what, the wealthy need to chip in and pay their fair share, if only to relieve the rest of us from overtaxation at the middle, particularly.
All right. Valentino in North Baton Rouge, you're on with Chuck Collins. Please be brief. Hi, Valentino.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, what are the pros and cons of a flat tax? One time there was a lot of discussion, but it was turned down.
What about a flat tax? Would that work?
Well, we have flat taxes at the state and local level. We have regressive taxes, local sales taxes. You know, it would work if all the loopholes were closed, but the problem is the rich lobby so much for these loopholes that they end up paying a lower effective tax rate in a lot of jurisdictions. So, you know, I think it's worth trying to have a flat tax for most of our tax systems, whether it's state income tax, but at the federal level, that's where we actually, there is some progressivity. The very wealthy are paying a higher bit more because at the local level, they're paying so much less.
All right. Patrick in Innisfil Estates. Patrick, you're on with Chuck Collins, the author of The Wealth Hoarders.
Hey, this guy speaks as if wealth is finite. It's not finite. You produce a wealth. You make a service. You make a product that people need. You just made the world a better place. And in turn, you get rich by contributing to the rest of society. And also, you know, what I find is a waste of taxes, special interests. A lot of these progressive special interest groups waste our tax money.
All right. Well, do most people get wealthy on their own, or do they get a head start from mom and dad and grandpa and grandma?
Well, there's clearly people who do start businesses and should be rewarded for what I'm concerned about is how our current tax system supports these great dynasties of wealth, how it's kind of entrenching inequality. And I understand, you know, Patrick's concern, but, you know, we need to make the kind of investments in public infrastructure and things that help people create wealth.
All right, we do have time for one more call in the final minute with Chuck Collins. Lou's been waiting patiently, I think, on Allen Road. Lou, you're on. Please be brief.
Hi. People who've worked all their lives in salary and were taxed have had to put the money into retirement funds. It seems like the Biden administration tax plans would now tax these at a high rate.
Is that the case? Are retirement funds going to be taxed at a higher rate?
No, that's not the case. The Biden plan is focused on people with incomes over $400,000 and mostly income over $1 million. And it's focused on, you know, taxing work at the same rate, tacking investments at the same rate as work. It's not going to go after your retirement funds.
Chuck Collins, thanks for your good work and congrats on your book, The Wealth Hoarders.
And thanks, Jim, for having me.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and we'll be calling again soon. And we'll be back after this quick timeout with E.J. Dionne, one of the best columnists in America. He's on deck. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. And Katie Ann McDonald is our producer. Your number is 877-217-5757. We turn the page, and we're joined by one of the best columnists in America from the Washington Post. His column appears in the Baton Rouge Advocate and Times-Picayune of New Orleans. And E.J. Dionne is with us. His column is in today's newspaper, Republicans Marooned on Trump Island. And he is here to talk about what is happening in our world. We're past 100 days now, the presidency of Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. E.J., how's he doing?
Robinette sounds like he could come from southern Louisiana, doesn't it? I just want to say it's great to be with you, and I was raised to think of myself as part of Louisiana because my dad, when he was in the Army, was stationed down there during much of World War II. So it is really cool to be with you. Thank you.
It's wonderful to hear your distinctive voice that we often hear in the afternoon and at other times on NPR. But please tell us your perception of the 46th president so far.
Well, I think Biden has been very smart in staying very focused on what he got elected to do and the core promises that Americans of all parties, I think, even people who are against him, would like him to keep. They want him to contain this virus, push it back, and get it out of our lives as much as possible. And our vaccination record as a country over the last 100 days has been really good. It's slowing down a bit. We've got some problems. I noticed right before I came on, there was a public service announcement saying, please get the vaccine. It's really important that we finish up vaccinating people. But we made a lot of progress. And then the second thing was to heal some of the economic problems, particularly for people stuck not at the top of the economy, which has done pretty well, but in the middle and the bottom. And the first relief bill did a lot for lots of Americans, middle class as well as low-income Americans. And now it comes the real test going forward. Joe Biden is essentially saying, look, we've been running down government for a long time. Government isn't always the problem. Government can actually help people solve problems. We certainly believe that of Social Security and Medicare for elderly Americans. He's now saying that government can help not only to do the basic stuff like build roads and bridges and transit and bring broadband to rural people, but also help people with elder care and child care, these real problems. I think a lot of people are saying he's adventurous and very progressive, and he is being adventurous and progressive. But a lot of these are ideas that have been kicking around for, you know, 10, 20 years. The child care problem that people confront in balancing work and family is not some new problem that snuck up on us. A lot of families have been struggling with that for decades. And so he's proposing we do something about it, and we're going to see a big fight in Congress, and we'll see how much he gets.
Well, we're visiting with a celebrated columnist by way of Harvard and Oxford, a Rhodes Scholar, E.J. Dionne, Eugene Joseph Dionne, Jr., and he is a man.
Thank you for that. Named after my dad. God bless him.
Obviously. And you mentioned him, and he sounds like he was a great man. And
he was a very good man. I wrote a column. Somebody, if anybody wants to search, they can go back. My dad taught me how to argue about politics. If you don't mind for just a sec. My dad was one of those fathers who didn't mind when his kids disagreed with him, and he thought that argument was a way people learn stuff. So I learned you could argue with people without hating them, And so he modeled a very different kind of approach to politics than the one we're having right now in our country. And I grew up in a very politically diverse family, so we argued all the time, but we didn't hate each other. I wish we could figure out how to do that again.
Well, you were 8 years old in the great city of Boston, I think, when President Kennedy was elected.
Correct.
Homegrown, and the times are different, needless to say. But how did that, you know, here you got the guy from Massachusetts, who, of course, went to Harvard as well, who becomes the 35th American president at 43 years old. And now we just elected a guy who's 78 years old. What do you think about how times have changed in many different ways in our country?
Well, I think in 1960, we were coming off the Eisenhower administration, which was a really unifying sort of Republican administration. I mean, all kinds of people liked Ike. A lot of Democrats liked Ike. A lot of people remembered him as the guy who led our troops and won World War II, and that was a very nonpartisan endeavor. And then you have, coming off one of the older presidents, this young and dashing president. As a kid, I always point out to people, I grew up in a Republican family, and yet even in our household, there was real excitement. Obviously, we're also Catholic, so that to have that breakthrough was a big deal. But also, there was a real sense of excitement when Kennedy was putting together his government. And you really sense that something new was going on. You know, I know JFK's inaugural address almost by heart, and that line, the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans. And it's interesting to think about that in light of Joe Biden, because in a way, he's out of that old, he is the last president we're going to have out of that old generation. And in a funny way, he is being called to, you know, bring us forward. Obviously, we can't move backward. But if there are things we want to repeat out of that period, it's this sense that we were relatively unified as a country. We were about to face big challenges on civil rights that we met. It created a lot of divisions afterward. I think what Biden is trying to do is sort of push that civil rights period to its culmination to have genuine equal rights, but also to pull us together across some of the other lines. It's very challenging. You know, I don't pretend that we are going to come together easily across party lines in the next 4 years, but maybe we could have a common sense of problem solving again. And that's why Biden, I think, is very specific when he talks about his promises. They're not ideological promises. They're, let's solve this problem of infrastructure, that problem of families taking care of their kids when they have to work, that sort of thing. I think a problem-solving politics has the potential of being more unifying.
E.J. Dionne is a columnist also for the Common Wheel, a liberal Catholic publication. Now, Joe Biden's the second Roman Catholic after John Kennedy to become president of the United States. Surprisingly, some might learn that there are lots of liberal Catholics in the United States of America.
Well, that's true. I mean, right now, the church is divided. And when I say the church, I mean the people of the church as well as the hierarchy of the church are really split quite badly. Catholics were split in the election of Joe Biden, which is peculiar. John F. Kennedy, by the way, got almost 80% of the Catholic vote. That's not surprising because he was the breakthrough figure. And I know I have very conservative friends whose parents never voted for any other Democrat but John F. Kennedy. And they voted for him because he was Catholic and they were Catholic. And they wanted to say, this barrier we want to knock down and then we'll go back to being Republicans again. This time, you really have a split in the church among those who say that the core issues that matter are abortion and, for some of them, opposition to advances in LGBTQ rights. And you have another camp in the church, and obviously I'm oversimplifying here, who really privilege social justice questions and who sort of look at the gospel and say the obligation is to stand up for the least of these. You know, in John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, Isaiah, to undo the heavy burdens and let the oppressed go free. And I think that split is visible. And so now you have some very, very conservative or right-wing bishops saying, you know, Joe Biden shouldn't take communion. And you have another wing of the bishops saying, that's crazy. We can't deny the president of the United States communion or anyone communion because of their political views. So I think you're going to see a fight, go on in the church over the next several years, just like you are in the rest of the country. We like to think sometimes that religion might bring us together rather than divide us, but right now I think it's doing a heck of a job of dividing us. I'm sorry to say that.
No. Patricia in Magnolia Woods has been waiting patiently. Please be brief, Patricia. You're on with EJ. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. I'm so glad to be able to talk to you. I love your columns.
Bless you. Thank you so much.
My question is, which of Biden's initiatives do you think has the best chance of succeeding?
I think of the new batch, obviously, roads, bridges, highways, rural broadband, transit, the sort of traditional, in quotes, definitions of infrastructure. The Republicans put out an alternative proposal. It was quite small, but the White House is sort of rather is not rejecting it. They're using it to say maybe we can get some bipartisan support on this. The hardest part will probably be the taxes, and there's some irony in that because Biden's proposals to increase taxes only on the very well-off, families earning over $400,000 a year, and on corporations is quite popular, but Republicans just don't seem to want to go anywhere near that. And then somewhere in the middle are proposals like the help for people with elderly parents or people raising kids as they work. And you'd like to think there would be more unity around those, but I think we're going to have a fight around the federal government's role in that.
All right. David in Atlanta. David, be brief. You're on with EJ. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Dion, you're a great writer. Keep up the good work. When President Clinton raised taxes without one Republican vote, Limbaugh wanted to bet the Democratic National Committee $1 million we'd have a recession in 2 years. We had the best economy probably in history. Unemployment came down every year.
All right, what's your question?
Deficit. Well, how illiterate are the Republicans when it comes to the economy on a scale of 1 to 10?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because I have a dear friend who's a Democrat who makes basically the point you just made, that Democrats have been really bad at bragging about their economic performance. And, you know, when you look at the recovery under Clinton, the 90s were pretty a pretty wildly good economic period, the recovery under Obama, and now under Biden. I think what you're seeing right now is Democrats are more comfortable than they were under Obama in saying, hey, look at the good we're doing. I think in the Obama years, a lot of Democrats were worried that they knew a lot of people were being left behind in the recovery.
We're going to be back with EJ in just a moment. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're wrapping it up with EJ Dion, the celebrated columnist for The Washington Post, and he was in full bloom when we hit the break and was making some good points. And EJ, his column appears in the Advocate / Picayune. Today, the headline, Republicans Marooned on Trump Island. EJ, I didn't want to cut you short. You were talking about the 46th American president and where he's going from here, and he is visiting Louisiana this week, which is kind of an odd choice because I don't know that he's going to pick off any votes in Congress from our delegation, but he's giving it a try, and he's got a majority, but it is the most slight of majorities. How's it looking?
One of the points of the column, and by the way, just to finish on the earlier caller, I think he's going to be happy that Biden will be doing some bragging on the Democrats and the economy. So just to finish that point before you had to move to break, I think Biden wants to send this signal of national unity that he's not just going to talk to people who voted for him. He's going to talk to people who voted against him and maybe people who would probably vote against him again, because the point he wants to make is for him, bipartisanship is not just whether he gets votes in Congress, it's whether he does things that help Republicans as well as Democrats. So I think you're going to see quite a lot of this from both Biden and Vice President Harris going to places that aren't necessarily Democratic places and trying to pull over at least some people who used to vote against Democrats. That was part of the point of the column today, that there is room to convert some people. but even send a signal to Republicans he'll be president for them, even if they don't like him very much. And that's a useful signal to send, I think, politically, possibly even for the country.
Well, I know you're short on time, but you did make a point that has not often been made in your column, saying Biden recouped some of his party's 2016 losses in 2020. He won 44% of the non-college vote. And to put that in perspective, Hillary Clinton, he won 48. Hillary Clinton was at 44, but Barack Obama, he was over 50% in both elections. The Democratic Party seems to have a problem with people who are less educated. Is that something that is going to be with us for as far as we can see, or can Biden and other Democrats go back to the way things were?
Well, I think the future of American politics hangs in significant part on the Democratic Party's ability to win back non-college people. That in some parts of the country, Democrats are viewed as an elitist party, the big metropolitan areas, big cities. And I thought it was very interesting in his address to Congress that Biden went out of his way to say the kind of jobs I'm creating are jobs for people without college training. One politician some years ago put it, well, you shouldn't have to go to college to join the middle class. We want to help everybody who can go to college to go to college or in a great college town there. But we want people to be able to make a decent living whether they go to college or not. And I think that's the message Biden's going to send over and over again. And we're going to see in the midterms and in 2024 if that has any impact in winning back some of the voters Democrats have lost.
EJ, a pleasure talking with you. We hope we do it again soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Take care. And unfortunately, we have a full board of calls, but we won't be able to get to all of them. But EJ does say he will be back soon. And we're joined by one of his colleagues at the Washington Post, Travis Andrews, features writer for the great newspaper in the Beltway. And his book is Because He's Jeff Goldblum, the movies that this enigmatic actor has been in over the course of a career now that spans almost four decades, actually a little more than four, have been memorable. And in many cases, he is one of the best-known actors in America, and others have seen his face and would recognize him but not know who the heck he was. Travis Andrews, native of New Orleans, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I know you are doing great work in the nation's capital, but you say you miss your native New Orleans.
I absolutely do. Now, every day I miss New Orleans, and I miss Baton Rouge, where I spent my college years.
Well, you're a Tiger, aren't you?
Absolutely, through and through. I got my my start at the Reveille, the daily paper over at LSU. And in fact, there's four of us from the Reveille at the Washington Post, which is pretty fun. On game days, we still dress up.
Isn't that something? Isn't that something? And I know a few of the others, but there are one. Well, tell us the others.
It's me, Amy Britton, J.J. Alcantara, and Natalie Jennings.
Yeah, and Amy was on with us not so long ago, but that's great that you dress in Tiger colors on game day. But Jeff Goldblum, an interesting choice for a big book and a very talented man, but not a classically handsome leading man. He's not Robert Redford. He's not Paul Newman. But yet you make a good case that he's one of the most talented actors we've seen over the last generation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I think that in a way, because he's not that classic handsome that you see in movie stars, he managed to bring a little bit more quirk and a little bit more of his unusual energy to the big screen that really kind of injects movies with something a little different. And I think audiences have really responded to that over the years.
He's a man of many interests. He's a great musician, isn't he?
He's a wonderful jazz pianist, and he's been playing for more than 30 years. Well, he's been playing since he was a teenager when he was growing up in Pittsburgh, and he would call local bars and say, "Hey, do you need a piano player?" And if someone said yes, he'd show up, and they'd be like, "Wait, you're like 15, 16. I don't think you can do this." But yeah, he's been playing for a very long time. Plays a little club out in L.A. when he's in town there, and he has now put out two records, both which I recommend, a very different side of him.
Well, he's had some hits and misses, as most actors do, and he is a busy, busy man. How many, have you counted the films that he's been in?
Oh, my Lord. I know it's more than 75.
Isn't that something?
The one thing, yeah, one thing about Goldblum is that he often isn't the leading man in a movie, which I think is better for him. One critic I spoke to, Adam Naiman, referred to him kind of like a spice. He's like a little Tony's or a little Slappy Mama. Like, you want a little of it to make the jambalaya a little bit better, but you don't want to just eat that straight. And so he shows up in movies oftentimes for these little 10, 15-minute almost cameos throughout the years that really just kind of spice him up a little bit. And I think because of that, he was able to have this incredible output.
The book is Because He's Jeff Goldblum. Now, he, in his early career, and we're going back to the 70s, early 70s. He got a big break in a couple of films from Robert Altman, didn't he?
He did, and it was so serendipitous. Robert Altman saw Goldblum in a play in New York, a pretty small play, and was just really struck by him, and so found out, you know, his phone number, gave him a call, flew him out to Los Angeles and said, I want to put you in a couple movies. So he put him in California Split, which is a classic Goldblum cameo. Goldblum's in it for maybe 15 seconds, and then cast him as the silent biker in Nashville, which is so funny because now we don't think of Goldblum as a very silent person. But in this movie, he doesn't speak a word.
Bill Downtown. Bill, you're on with Travis Andrews, the author of Because He's Jeff Goldblum. Hi, Bill.
My first recollection of Goldblum is in Buckaroo Banzai. How does that fit into his body of work?
I think Buckaroo Banzai is sort of the quintessential Jeff Goldblum. It's him at his quirkiest, as weirdest, playing New Jersey. And if you remember in the movie, there's a great moment where they're running through kind of a spaceship type thing, and there's a watermelon just sitting there. And Goldblum just goes, why is that watermelon there? And it's a classic line from the movie, and it was completely improv. He kind of broke character to literally ask, why is there a watermelon there? And it made it into the movie, and I think that's very Goldblum-y.
Now, you mentioned he's probably better not as a leading man, but he has been, and most effectively in 1986 in The Fly. Also, as you note, he was cast in Into the Night, which is now a bit of a cult classic. Your thoughts about those films?
I think Into the Night is a cult classic, and it's a great movie. I think tonally it suffers a little bit. It doesn't quite know if it's dramatic or if it's comedic. It gets pretty dark at times. I still enjoy the movie, but when comparing it to something like The Fly, I think very few movies can live up to that. The Fly is a masterpiece. I truly believe he should have won an Oscar for his performance as Seth Brundle. The makeup artist did win an Oscar, rightfully so. They spent 6-7 hours a day putting that makeup on Goldblum for all the various stages of his disintegrating fly body. But, you know, I think he brings such an empathy to that character that when he starts to kind of lose control, you feel like you're losing control. And by the end of the movie, I think it's hard to really do anything else but spend a good 5-10 minutes just sitting there thinking about what you just saw. And not many movies have that power.
Now, he married his leading lady from The Fly, Gina Davis, and they were a fun couple for a while, and a most interesting couple.
Absolutely, and they made some very interesting films together, including Earth Girls Are Easy, which, you know, when you come from The Fly, this very serious, very dark body horror from David Cronenberg to this, you know, 80s neon colorful romp where he and Jim Carrey play aliens who, underneath their alien exteriors, are very attractive men. It was a very interesting period for him, and I think Gina Davis kind of brought him into the comedic world a little bit more that we now see he still kind of plays in these days.
The book is Because He's Jeff Goldblum. It's a fun book, and you'll find out a lot about Hollywood and movies for the last half century from Travis Andrews, features writer for The Washington Post, native of New Orleans, and graduate of LSU. Congrats, Travis, and let's talk again.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services.